This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. The last major American tax reform was 1986. Rates were cut, deductions eliminated. And as importantly as any element of policy contained in that bill, it was remarkably popular. For tax reform today, Cato Vice President John Samples discusses the 86 reform and what it has to offer today's debate.
The 1986 tax reform, which was brought about by bipartisan efforts. It had started with Bill Bradley and the Democratic leadership. Ronald Reagan got on board. There was some resistance within his administration to it, including our former chairman, Bill Niskanen, wasn't all that excited about it at the time. But ultimately, it did pass, and the crucial Republican was Bob Packwood, who was on the Senate side and was expected to actually oppose it. But it did happen. It wasn't supposed to happen. Right now, the current one is not supposed to happen. So it's possible that it could happen. 1986 tax reform was one of the most extraordinary things, I think, that has happened in my lifetime in some ways in terms of getting the system to work.
What were the keys to making that tax reform work?
I think in terms of getting it through, Reagan was very important. The fact that Reagan was willing to endorse it, even in the sixth year of his two presidential terms, and that he stayed behind it and nursed it through to the end. Presidential leadership was important. Having bipartisanship to it was good. I mean, I think that was part of the Republican doubts about it was that there was $125 million in taxes that were moved around. So there were, in some sense, increases in some ways, mostly for corporations. On the other hand, there was a lower tax rate that President Reagan got for it. But as I said, Bob Packwood, the head of the Senate Finance Committee at the time, was crucial because he changed his mind during the process. He was initially against it, and he changed his mind and decided to be for it. And when he did, it really changed the bargaining really quickly. All the forces that were against it were caught out. They thought that things were going pretty well, that nothing was going to change. And Packwood turning on a dime really shook everything up and caused a general panic, I think, too. But too late. It was a done deal.
What was the policy case for the tax reform, and what were the nuts and bolts of it, and sort of what parallels could you draw between then and potentially now?
There's a number of ways of looking at it. I mean, for the Democrats, for people like Bill Bradley, there was a distributional question. They thought that most of the tax breaks went to the upper parts of the wealth and income distribution. And so for them, it was a kind of equity issue. I believe for libertarians, there's actually an important issue, and it's odd, an odd one, because it actually, I think, is not best thought of as a tax matter in the following sense. You have to realize that all of these loopholes or tax preferences, more formally, in the tax code are really what Congress thinks they're doing with these is managing the economy. They think they're increasing the housing supply or supporting the housing industry, or they think they're doing other things by giving specific breaks. Also, just investment in general, they think, is very important. So they see these tax preferences really as a form of managing the economy. And as libertarians or classical liberals, we believe that those kinds of management are not needed and likely to be counterproductive. There's also the public choice argument that goes closely with that, which is that most of these preferences are a result of offering highly concentrated benefits to highly organized industries or groups of individuals, whereas the cost of them or even knowledge of them are passed along to dispersed groups. So it's a classic argument that, you know, really you have interest groups that are highly powerful, highly dug in, and getting and their organization is paid for, and there's an incentive to do it because of the nature of the benefits. So in you could say see it in a more colloquial sense as corruption, but it's bad policy. It's bad policy any way you go at it. Now, so that's still true. That was an argument known in 1986. What is also true is that 1986 did not get to the largest and most popular and somewhat broad-based one. Tax preferences, including the mortgage deduction, which is, you know, means a lot of people itemize. Gives you a break for your mortgage interest. And you have to remember that the real estate, well, this is something that's actually not widely known. When you ask what is the largest and industry here in Washington, the largest interest group, you might think it's a number of different things, maybe pharmaceuticals or something. It's actually real estate, and there's a concern there about preserving, I think, those kinds of tax issues. The other thing beyond the tax deduction is the deduction for state and local taxes, which means if you're in a high-tax state like New York or Illinois or California, and California has a 14% income tax rate, you get to deduct those taxes against your national tax burden. So in a sense, particularly from a libertarian point of view, you're really the tax preferences are supporting more spending than would otherwise exist in those states, because the states would have to be competitive. If they wanted those kinds of tax rates, they would not be able to sustain them, I don't think. Basically, the state and local tax deduction lowers taxes overall in those states and on the surface, and probably in general, it means that their spending would be less since they often have a requirement to balance their budget. So mayors, governors, those kinds of people, highly concentrated, relatively small number of people are going to be wildly supportive of that kind of preference. And in fact, they were in 1986, and we didn't get anywhere close to getting rid of either of those deductions. So that's the same, and it looks – so far it doesn't look good there. I would think the big difference here and – The big difference is we're going in now, and the groups that support the current status quo, they are very aware of what happened, and they are very much on their attention. They're really ready to go, ready to fight this out. That was somewhat true perhaps in 86, but things changed really quickly, as I said, mostly with Packwood. You know, it does look like you're going to have something like that to get something serious through. The other thing is, I think the questions out there is President Trump has committed, as interested, and as skillful as Ronald Reagan was in 1986 in bringing this about. And can he work with, in some measure, members of the Democratic Party to get this through? Can he recruit some of those? Because it's probably still true that many Democrats think these preferences could go and would like to see them.
If you're talking about interest groups, there have to be some.
Well, one thing I would say is there's going to be also people from a libertarian or other conservative perspective who are going to be against this. And what they're going to say is it's going to increase people's taxes. And it is true, and it is true that the taxes in 1986, as I said, were raised by $125 million. But other taxes were lowered. These things tend to be more or less revenue neutral. So you can't focus on those specific things and then hope that maybe you could get all the taxes down, which would be better, but you can't really hope that in this context of tax reform. So I think it's instead of thinking of it that way as a tax increase for some people, I would think of it as a rolling back of the state. Once you get rid of the preferences, you also get rid of this attempt to manage the economy, because that's what it is. It's an attempt to have a political direction of the economy through tax cutting rather than spending, because tax cutting is easier politically and more attractive. So if we think of it as a tax increase, we make it harder because – and prevent ourselves, I think, actually, from a good result, which is reducing the size of the state and its scope.
John Samples is author of The Struggle to Limit Government. He's also a Cato Institute vice president. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.